was based at the Ismaili Institute, or the Institute for Ismaili Studies. Dr. Nida Damadi is a researcher in Muslim biomedical ethics at the Institute of Ismaili Studies, and today he'll be talking to us under the title, with this recent seminar, under the title of Is Life Sacred? Sanctity of Life Arguments in Muslim Bioethics. And on that note, I'm going to just take a step back and hand over to Dr. Yasmin Damadi, who will take us for the next few minutes, after which I'm going to just tell everyone now the onset. If we, including myself, mute our mics until the end of the presentation, after which we can have a discussion and question answer session, which I'll be chairing. So on that note, I'm going to mute our mic, and we can give a virtual welcoming round of applause to Aghay Mirdamad.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Sheikh Tajri. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Okay, so the title of my presentation, as I suppose you can see it, is Life Sacred? Sanctity of Life Arguments in, between parentheses, Muslim Bioethics and Apophatic Appraisal. I deliberately put Muslim between parentheses because I think my discussion, if sound, can be also applied to Christian and Jewish bioethics, among other monotheistic religions. Okay, the outline of my presentation will be like this. First, I will be talking about the meaning of the sanctity of life theory. What does it mean? Then I will be talking about the religious foundation, the religious formulation of the sanctity of life theory. Then I will be talking about the Abrahamic roots of the sanctity of life theory. And then I'll get to the Islamic, or what is taken to be the Islamic roots of the sanctity of life theory. Then I will be discussing very briefly two cases when the sanctity of life theory is applied. In these two cases, I mean abortion and euthanasia as the two bioethical cases. And then, at the end, I will be very briefly discuss an apophatic critique of the sanctity of life theory, or one might say an apophatic reformulation in a moderate way, an apophatic reformulation of the sanctity of life theory. Okay, this is the outline. So what is the sanctity of life? So, as you can see, it is a theory which is not used in the bioethics, but it is mainly used in bioethics. And roughly speaking, it's a theory that takes human life. So the focus is on human life, which takes human life as having an inherent value, intrinsic value. I mean value regardless of any other considerations. It's not a derived value. So here, intrinsic or inherent is contrasted with derived value. So, of course, there are a lot of things in our life which has a value, but its value is derived, not in itself. For example, of course, we value, for example, having a laptop or book or pencil, but not because of themselves, but because they provide us with a capability to do our job. So, having laptop or book or pen or pencil, or iPad or cell phone, they are valuable, but they have a derived value. Their values are derived from other, actually more underlying values that they are in the service of actually satisfying that functions. So this is called the intrinsic value. But in contrast, intrinsic value is valuable for itself, not for doing anything else. So life as such, according to the sanctity of life theory, is valuable. And that is the sanctity of life theory. Of course, the practical consequence of taking human life to be intrinsically valuable is that human life is to be in principle protected. The sanctity of life theory historically has a religious actually roots, but there are also some one might say philosophical formulations of the sanctity of life theory, like the formulation suggested by Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher, or more recently suggested by Ronald Dworkin, and a professor of law. But these are more or less philosophical, non-religious, or one might say secular versions of sanctity of life theory, which are not our concern here in this presentation. So my focus will be on the religious version of the sanctity of life theory, which is historically the root and the foundation of the sanctity of life theory. And of course, sanctity of life theory in bioethical discussion is usually, not always, but usually is appealed to in order to take a position against the permissibility of, for example, abortion or euthanasia. Okay, so before going any further, so let me formulate the religious version of the sanctity of life theory. So this is my effort. So this can be formulated like this. Premise number one, humanity is created in the image of God. So the idea of the image of God lies at the heart of the religious version of the sanctity of life theory. Premise two, whatever is created in the image of God has, for this very reason, a special value or dignity. And, of course, the conclusion, hence humanity has a intrinsically and a special value or dignity. For example, premise one could be taken from Old Testament, Genesis 1:27, which reads, God created human beings in his own image. And you know, we have also the prophetic, actually, hadith attributed to Prophet Muhammad, which resembles this Genesis 1:27, which says that, خَلَقَ اللَّهُ آدَمَ عَلَى صُورَتِهِ, which is almost a literal translation, an Arabic literal translation of this Old Testament verse. But having a more general Abrahamic picture, so the Abrahamic roots of the sanctity of life theory is like this. The basic assumption, for example, in Jewish tradition, which is expressed in Mishnah, and Mishnah, we know that the Mishnah is the oral part of the Talmud, and Talmud is the actually the code of law in both civil law and religious law in Judaism. In Mishnah we read, whoever destroys a soul, it is considered as if he destroyed an entire world. And whoever saves a life, it is considered as if he saved an entire world. A theme which is quite familiar to us, because we have a quite similar theme in the Quran, to which I shall later on return. In the New Testament, for example, since human beings have been created in the image of God, imago Dei, for example, Genesis 1:26-27, or already actually recited 1:27, the loving God is then within us. But specifically in Christian theology, the idea of incarnation also being interpreted as a specifically Christian foundation for the sanctity of life theory. In the sense that the enfleshment of God in the human person of Jesus means that human life has become sacred. Okay, so now let us talk a little bit about the Islamic roots of the sanctity of life theory. Of course, also in Muslim scripture and also in Muslim theology, human being is widely, but not unanimously, but widely considered as the God's noblest creatures, since God has breathed His spirit into the human being. وَنَفَخْتُ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِ. This is interpreted by Muslim jurists in a literal way. This is the key point, which is quite relevant to our discussion in bioethics. The literal translation of this very, one might say, mystical or esoteric Quranic verses by Fuqaha, the outcome of which is that every human body, male and female, at a certain stage of its embryological development becomes person or begins to become person. So, and then when exactly? So when that, the so-called ensoulment happens, well, according to a prophetic hadith attributed to Prophet Muhammad, it happens in roughly 120 days. That's why, I'll get back to it, that's why that actually, that time frame is very important for Muslim jurists when it comes to the permissibility or impermissibility of abortion. So due to divine root of human creation, the value of a single human bears the value of humankind altogether. You may remember that I mentioned Mishnah, if you destroy someone, it is as if you have destroyed humankind. And this theme is exactly reflected also in the Quran. And this is the Surah 5, Ayah 32. We prescribe for the children of Israel shall be as if he had, if you kill someone, it will be as if he had slain mankind altogether. And who gives life to a soul shall be as if he, that who slays a soul, not to retaliate for a soul slain, not for corruption done in the land, has given life to a mankind altogether. Okay, I'm sorry to say that this in English translation is messed up, but the original Quranic is مَنْ قَتَلَ نَفْسًا بِغَيْرِ نَفْسًا أَوْ فَسَادًا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَكَأَنَّمَا قَتَلَ النَّاسَ جَمِيعًا وَمَنْ أَحْيَاهَا فَكَأَنَّمَا أَحْيَا النَّاسَ جَمِيعًا. Exactly the main theme which was mentioned in the Mishnah. So that's why it is as if there is something as a humanity as such, humankind as such. If you destroy one part of it, it is as if you have destroyed the whole. Because the tiny part or each member of that humanity bears actually the hallmark of the whole humanity. So the humanity is taken as a unified whole. If you destroy a part of it, you have destroyed the whole. And if you actually keep a part of it alive, it is as if you have kept the whole alive. So these are the Islamic roots of the sanctity of life theory. Now, let me very briefly mention two cases in which sanctity of life theory can be applied. For example, in the case of abortion, human life, this sanctity of life theory can be appealed to make abortion morally and, of course, religiously impermissible. So how to appeal to sanctity of life theory to make abortion impermissible? So here is a rough formulation. Premise number one, human life is intrinsically valuable in such a way that its value overrides other conflicting matters. So this is the sanctity of life theory premise. Okay? Fetus as a human being has a human life. This is premise number two, which tries to instantiate the general rule of sanctity of life theory. Okay? So, bringing together, this argument gives rise to this conclusion. Therefore, abortion as an instance of intentionally terminating human life is morally wrong. So again, sanctity of life theory is appealed to in order to make abortion impermissible, both, of course, morally and religiously. Okay, to give it more flesh and meat and bone, abortion before 120 days of gestation, or even after that, without medical reasons, specifically when mother's life is in danger, is considered unlawful, roughly, of course, by Muslim jurists. Of course, there are some Hanafi jurists that give permission for abortion even before not after 120 days, but before that, even without medical reasons, but of course with the husband's consent. But more or less, the general rule is that even before 120 days, without medical reason, and specifically without when mother's life is not in danger, abortion is not permissible. And after 120 days, the same applies even for Hanafis, some of whom take even before 120 days to be okay, but after 120 days, not okay. So this is a rough characterization of the application of sanctity of life argument in this case. And of course, if you ask a jurist, he wouldn't say he because usually they are he, they are male. He wouldn't say that, okay, it's not permissible because of sanctity of life argument. Instead, he refers to some Quranic verses of prophetic ahadith. But when you analyze that ahadith, one theme which is common in some Quranic verses or prophetic ahadith are sanctity of life arguments. So the case number two is euthanasia. Okay, how to use sanctity of life arguments to argue against the ethical permissibility of euthanasia? Here is a suggested formulation. Premise number one, human life is intrinsically valuable in such a way that its value overrides other conflicting matters. We are already familiar with this formulation from the abortion case. So this is the sanctity of life theory premise. Premise number two, which is the instantiation premise. So premise number one is general rule premise. cobra, as we were taught in the Hausa. So the second premise is Sohra. Euthanasia violates the intrinsic value of human life. Okay? So no one is supposed to violate the intrinsic value of human life, but euthanasia does violate the intrinsic value of human life. And the conclusion, therefore, euthanasia is in principle not morally permissible. And more concretely, Muslim Jews do not allow, usually, maybe I can claim here unanimously, do not allow active euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. But some fuqaha would allow non-voluntary passive euthanasia. So the point is, although the strict version of sanctity of life argument does not make a morally relevant distinction between active and passive euthanasia. So let me say it again. The strict version of sanctity of life argument does not make a morally relevant distinction between active and passive euthanasia. Therefore, from that strict version of, or the maximalist version of the sanctity of life argument, even passive, non-voluntary euthanasia is not permissible. But a moderate version of sanctity of life argument can take the distinction between active euthanasia and passive euthanasia as morally relevant, and then that might lead them to take this position that maybe non-voluntary passive euthanasia is morally permissible. And here is the quotation from the Council of Islamic Jurisprudence and Organization of the Islamic Conference. In the case of, a direct quotation, in the case of a patient whose body has been hooked up to life support, it is permissible to remove it if all his brain function has ceased completely, and a committee of three specialists, experienced doctors, have determined that this cessation of function is irreversible, even if the heart and breathing are still working mechanically with the help of a machine. So this is a case of non-voluntary passive euthanasia. Okay, so far I've been trying to formulate sanctity of life argument. I was trying to suggest the roots and the found and the religious roots, Christian, Jewish, Islamic, and also I actually presented two cases in which sanctity of life arguments was applied. Now, at the final part of my presentation, I'm going to suggest an apophatic argument or reformulation of the sanctity of life theory, which I found almost non-existent in the bioethical literature. So it could be a contribution to the literature, and I'm more than happy if I can benefit from your considerations. Okay, here is an apophatic argument against the sanctity of life theory. Premise one, the sacredness or sanctity is reserved only for God. Premise two, I'm sure that the premise one is widely accepted by all religious believers. So premise one, at least religiously, is not so controversial. So premise two, apophatic premise, which of course might be more controversial. God is unsurpassably above and beyond. And God's being above and beyond is both ontologically and epistemologically. in the sense that God is beyond how God is, and God is beyond how we perceive God to be. Okay, this is premise number two. Premise number three, human is not God. I'm sure that this is also not controversial. Even atheists or agnostics could actually endorse to that premise. So, conclusion number one, humanity is not intrinsically sacred. Conclusion number two, human life as such is not sacred. And the final conclusion would be the sanctity of life argument is not defensible. In the sense that human life as such is not sacred. So, but the main point here is that this apophatic criticism of sanctity of life argument is not against the sanctity argument altogether. It is against what is called, or what can be called, the intrinsic version of sanctity of human life. In the sense that we are not supposed to do something to acquire sanctity. We are already sacred, intrinsically, essentially. So this essentialistic or intrinsical version of sanctity of life is what is being actually denied and criticized by this apophatic argument. But, and this is a very important but an apophatic critique might still accept something that can be called the acquired model of sanctity of life argument, in the sense that if someone cultivates virtues based on the divine guidance, of course one can acquire sanctity. One can become Qaddis. One can become Muqaddas. One can acquire Hurma. But no one a priori is sacred. No human life as such is sacred. Okay, I'm done. It was short. Okay, hope I can benefit from your considerations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Mirdam Ali, for a very insightful presentation and very informative. I'll ask now, we have a few questions by text, but if first and foremost, if I can ask anyone who does wish to ask a question, of course we're going to have to control this so we don't all start repeating and speaking verbally all at once. But if anyone wants to ask their question verbally, if they can indicate that on the chat, first of all, on the right-hand side, and then we can then they can proceed to unmute their mic. If we don't have, then we will ask the question, a couple of questions which we've already had on the text. So if anyone wants to proceed unmuting their mic, then we can proceed to ask. So someone is asking on the chat, could we still have the slide up on the screen? Which slide they want particularly from Rai Medamadi, I'm not sure which particular slide they want, or with the premises, right, the slide which has the premises on it, on them. Okay, if anyone has a question, otherwise we will take the question by text. Rai Medamadi, I'll tell you the first question which is here by text already is, how far can we go saying that Islam subscribes to the sanctity of life theory as described, given that the Qur'an gives exceptions or circumstances that seem to allow the taking of a life, in the Qur'an saying, بِغَيْرِ نَفْسٍ أَوْ فَسَادٍ, indicating the exceptions in which you would be, or one would be permitted to take a human life. So that's the first question, and we'll take more questions either by text or verbally as well. So I'll hand over to you and mute myself again, Dr. Mirdam Ali.
Yeah, I mean, okay, actually those who have a sympathy with the usual version of sanctity of life theory should actually answer this question, but I'm trying to answer on their behalf. they might say that sanctity of life theory is not going to be compromised by the exceptions that are made in the Quran. من قتل نفسا بغير نفس أو فسادا في الأرض. If someone make a facade, or if someone kills someone else, this is gonna be an exception to the sanctity of life. Okay, and the objection might be going like this, that okay, if something is intrinsic, it means it cannot be actually compromised. No exception can be made, because this is intrinsic, this is zero sum, this is this is not a mushakkak, this is mutawati. There is no matter of grade as far as something is intrinsic, metaphysically speaking. If something is absolute or without any grade, it's a matter of either or. So no exception can be made. So this is then an objection. Then one might raise against the intrinsic model of the sanctity of human life, which I have a kind of sympathy, but I'm trying to argue on their behalf. They might say, no, still human life is sacred, but if you put the sanctity of human life in danger, therefore you should be punished. So they might say that when we kill someone who has killed someone else without any excuse, or if we kill someone who has made facade or corruption in the world, we are preserving the dignity of human life and the sanctity of human life. So this is not for us to compromise or undermine the sanctity of life. Rather, we are preserving human life. So, also, I personally do not have very sympathy with this argument, but I think it has a kind of convincing force. So therefore, coming from apophatic perspective myself, I may not raise that objection against the usual model of the sanctity of life argument.
Thank you, Dr. Mudamadi. I know we have a couple of more questions, but since you raised that kind of follow-up question from myself, from what you just mentioned, it seems, therefore, that from this theory, it certainly flies in the face of the idea that the human life is sacrosanct in of itself or intrinsically, especially when you consider, so this, for example, where the Quran says, "Oh, fasad," as well. How that fasad is going to be judged and interpreted to be a violation of the dignity of human life is up to the reader, of course, to interpret that. And when you have, we know when you mentioned about abortion, when the mother's life is in danger, then also the mother's life is graded above and beyond, in terms of value, the life of the unborn human fetus, and also in euthanasia, those who would disallow it, the value of human freedom and human choice is also downgraded in place of human life being more sacred. So throughout all of these cases, we're seeing the value of human life can be graded above or below other aspects, and therefore to say that human life is intrinsically sacred and sacrosanct doesn't seem to hold that much water. I'll mute myself again now.
I have sympathy with you. I mean, let me get back, if you see my PowerPoint, let me see how deliberately I formulated sanctity of life in a strong version. So that was deliberate, because my intention was not and is not to destroy the sanctity of life argument. But my actual intention here is to let us reformulate, let us think about it again. So if I can find my, where is it? Mm-hmm. No. Where was it? Okay. No, it was not here. Okay. Let's take this one. You know, here it is said, premise number one, human life is intrinsically valuable in such a way that, so my emphasis here is on in such a way that onwards, its value overrides other conflicting matters. And as Sheikh Tajri said, and the one respectable interlocutor asked, there are a lot of cases in which the intrinsic value of human life has been overridden by some other considerations, like conflicting with others' interests, conflicting with community interests, conflicting with justice, freedom, and other considerations. So therefore, I think intrinsic value, or the strong version of sanctity of life, cannot hold water. But not only because of having conflict with some other matters. Of course, it is also another argument, secular argument, one might say, against sanctity of life argument. For example, there is an argument against sanctity of life argument saying that what would you do when the dignity of humanity is contrasted with the sanctity of human life? A patient is in a severe agony, he or she suffers, and in an incurable way, and in a very severe way. So in such a situation, if you say, no, human life is sacred, so you should not actually discontinue, you should not prevent yourself from treating this patient, so you let the patient suffer, and that suffering might compromise the dignity of the patient, and even religiously, such a patient might even cease to believe in God. Okay, so I totally believe in some other criticism against the strong version of sanctity of life argument, like the dignity versus sanctity. But my point is that in addition to this kind of other arguments, even the concept of sanctity, to which the advocates of the sanctity of life argument appeal, needs more reflection theologically. Because, you know, my point is, usually when we are talking about the sanctity, we are talking about the sanctity deliberately or otherwise, willingly or unwillingly, from a what is called cataphatic or positive theology, in such a way that we know what God is, therefore what sanctity is, and therefore how God has conferred that sanctity upon us. So this is very positive or cataphatic theology. One might say tashbih, anthropomorphic theology. While if we get back to the very, I mean, of course marginal, but still very alive and very promising apophatic or negative theology, then we might give pause and think about that. What is sacred? Of course, God is sacred, but what we can see around us is not sacred. It is human. Of course, it's respectable, have a right. We are not nihilists. We are not saying that because nothing around us as such is sacred, therefore we are allowed to do whatever we want. No, I'm not buying this argument that if the sanctity is not widespread, is not ubiquitous, therefore we end up becoming nihilistic. No, it's not like that. But on the contrary, if you make everything sacred, you end up compromising sanctity. So better reserve sanctity for what it is. So I'm more inclined into apophatic position with regard to sanctity, and taking that position, of course, would actually undermine at least the strong version of the sanctity of life. How to reformulate the sanctity of life argument in the light of apophatic theology, it could be discussed. So it's a matter of debate. I'm suggesting that we need to work on it. Okay? This is not a purely very fiqhi discussion. It's a more theological, but it has a consequences in fiqh and in bioethics. So it's very important. It's a kind of very interesting interdisciplinary discussion, which is a matter of research. As I said, it's almost non-existent, even in Christian theology, let alone in Jewish and Muslim bioethical theology or bioethical discussions related to theology. So this is actually a food for thought, and this is an area which is not investigated fully. And I think it's very promising. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mirdamadi, for that clarification. I know with the fascinating discussion has engendered quite a bit of few talking points and questions, which I can see in the chat here. I would encourage those people who have questions, and I can see a couple already have already indicated that they want to ask verbally. I would appreciate if possible for those who can ask verbally to do it that way. So first, I know I have a couple already. Brother Ahmed Kaori is willing to ask a question, and after that, Sister Madia also wants to ask a question. And I would also encourage everyone who can ask verbally to do it that way. If not, then we can take it via the chat, but I'll give priority to those ones. That being said, I would also please request the questions to be kept brief and to the point. I do, by the way, have the power to mute you. I don't have to mute use that power. So first I will ask Ahmed Kaori to unmute his mic and ask his question briefly, and we'll move on to the next question after that.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. My question is mainly regarding the argument itself in the sanctity of human life put forward based on humans being created in the image of God. But even so, it could be argued, I think, in a religious context, that life beyond death, is still sacred in itself. And one going through, for instance, feeling themselves having their dignity stripped from them and their freedom stripped from them, may still be believers in God. But when I get away from the shackles of this life and bypassing this life, because their life they believe is sacred in itself. So it seems that the command, from a religious perspective, Islamic, the preservation of life, comes down from a deontological perspective, and it would be the norm, something normative, based on the command of God that. Based on the ayah, that's من قتل نفس بغير نفس أو فساد في الأرض فكأنما قتل الناس جميعا. It seems to be from a preservation, from an Islamic perspective at least, is something that is put forward by God Himself, rather than it being derived from something intrinsic that we would say. I'll stop there.
Yeah. Okay. So we could ask Dr. Mirdamadi to respond.
Okay. So, I didn't quite get the question part of it. So that was a very good explanation. I have sympathy with it. What was the question? Can you just reformulate the question for me, please?
I mean, the question would be: can we? It doesn't strip away from the sanctity of life if someone passes this life. If we base it on premises, you would say P1, anything with sanctity must be preserved in this life of this world. P2, when human life is sacred, therefore human life must be preserved. But it doesn't seem to fit. It doesn't take away someone choosing to have euthanasia just for the sake of argument. Does not believe that they are. They may believe that they've got still their life is has sanctity, but beyond this world.
Okay.
So Okay. Of course, one might say, okay, it's still. I mean, it's a very good point actually. One might say, if I reformulate the objection in a very quick way, that even if someone taking your human life on the earth, it doesn't mean that, in the case of euthanasia, it doesn't mean that sanctity of life is compromised, because you might live somewhere else. But the point is that in this trying version of sanctity of life argument, taking human life, even if you might live on somewhere else in the hereafter, is not allowed. And taking human life without necessity is against the sanctity of human life. So, let me bring a very exaggerated case. It's like Nietzsche saying that God is dead. When God is dead, the sacredness ends, because God is the source of sanctity. But exactly like that, if we take from the strong version of sanctity of life argument, if we take human life to be intrinsically valuable, therefore killing people without excuse is like killing sanctity. It's like putting an end to the sacredness. That's why the advocates of the strong version of sanctity of life argument is against them. Against, in the strong version, they are against, for example, euthanasia altogether, and they are against abortion altogether, maybe only with the exception of mother's life being in danger. But even there are some fuqaha saying that, at least in the past, not maybe not contemporary fuqaha, but in the past there has been even some fuqaha saying that because we are not totally sure about the health of mother being compromised, even in a case of danger, therefore even in that case abortion is not permissible. So that shows how strongly their advocacy of sanctity of human life, of course influenced by their reading of the scripture, has actually pushed them to take a position against abortion or euthanasia.
Thank you, Dr. Medamadi. Now I'm going to ask Mahdia to unmute her mic and ask her question, after which, after that question has been answered, Brother Rila has also expressed on the chat that he's willing to ask his question verbally, which is fantastic. So after Mahdia's question has been answered by Dr. Medamadi, we'll move to Rila asking his question, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum. I wanted to ask about your final slide, and particularly the point where you say that sanctity may be acquired through cultivating virtue. Does this result in a situation, or could it result in a situation where some human beings have sanctity of life whilst others don't because they haven't cultivated the right virtues?
Yes, it does, Mahdiye. But I'm sure you might say this is very elitistic position to take. As we say in Persian, it is very nukhbe-garayane, which has a kind of negative connotation. But of course, it does. It does have this consequence that some are sacred because they have cultivated sacredness in themselves, and some are not. But it doesn't mean that those who doesn't have a sacredness, we can do whatever with them. We can kill them. We can take their right away. No, that's not like that. But the problem with sanctity of life, from an apophatic perspective, is that a kind of an ontological equality, not legal. Legal equality is something else. Ontological equality that you give to people, and it's, I'm not sure it's very, you know, very promising to take this position that an ascetic, a arif, a zahid, has an ontological equality in principle with someone who is who's like Hitler or Stalin, stuff like that, who has never cultivated any virtue in themselves. Yeah.
Thank you, Doctor. I'll ask Brother Reza to unmute his mic and ask his question also.
Yeah, thank you very much, Sheikh Fajri, and thank you very much, Dr. Yasser. Actually, Mahdiya just put my question more eloquently. I think, Dr. Yasser, you addressed part of it. But the other part is that if the point that we're trying to address is that, okay, if life has its own sanctity or not, right? So the context is, can we take life, right? That's to me, that's the question that we're trying to answer now. Can we take life? And we go to to arguments on whether this life is sacred or not. But the last slide that actually Mahdiya referred to, to me that phrase seems, not to answer this question. That, acquiring these or cultivating virtue. How does cultivating virtue help us address that question whether we can take life or not? Because to me it's a yes or no question. And cultivating virtue, does it change this answer at all? Like, the more virtue you get, the more towards a no the answer would be, or vice versa. Do you see my point? Thanks.
Thank you very much. Very, very, very pressing question, actually. An essential one. Okay. First thing first, it doesn't imply that if you take this apophatic position, taking a life would be, in principle, so much different from the cataphatic or positive theological position as reflected in the strong version of sanctity of life argument. Because even in that version, in some cases, lives can be taken. Fasadan, قَتَلَ نَفْسًا أَوْ فَسَادًا فِي الْأَرْضِ. If you kill someone, you are supposed to be punished. And the punishment would be, in some cases, capital punishment. And if you do fasad, you might be put to death. So, both apophatically or cataphatically, the idea of taking life might be there. Okay? But if I add something a little bit more radical here, so I agree that in the final conclusion or in the final analysis, to make that kind of virtue-based theory of sanctity of life. So let me explain a little bit further. So to take an apophatic position actually leads us to acquired model of sanctity. And what is key in the acquired model of sanctity of life is virtue. So that's why I'm saying virtue based of sanctity of life. I agree that virtue based theory of sanctity makes sanctity of life irrelevant to both bioethics and, of course, to the legal aspect of euthanasia and abortion. And of course, you might say that this is a downside or the negative aspect of it, but I'm not sure, because those who are virtue ethicists or has a kind of advocacy in virtue ethics, they would say that. And if you survey bioethics or bioethical literature, you would find a lot of discussion about consequentialism, specifically utilitarianism, and also about deontology, the Kantian or non-Kantian version. But you can very rarely find discussion about permissibility or impermissibility of abortion or euthanasia or organ transplantation from a virtue ethical perspective. Why? Because from a virtue ethical perspective, it's almost impossible to pass an ethical judgment. Because this is a very person-to-person based version. So virtue ethicists, they are against generalizing. There is no such a thing as deontologists like Kant would say that. There is a maxim that can be applied to all people. So virtue ethicists are against it. Therefore, if we reformulate sanctity of life in terms of the virtue cultivation, I agree. But this needs to be further investigated. But I agree, roughly, that the end result might be that even that sanctity is irrelevant to bioethics. And I have sympathy with that probably logical conclusion of my discussion. You might say it's too much, but it might be the positive aspect of it. Of course, there are some other considerations, like interest of the person, like interest of the community, like fairness, justice, freedom, other consideration that can be appealed to in order to come up with a judgment. Whether voluntary passive euthanasia is permissible or not. But appealing to sanctity, the positive version didn't work, as we try to say, because it doesn't do justice to the concept of sanctity. And the negative version, it might save the concept of sanctity, but it comes at a price. And the price is that it might make it irrelevant to bioethics. And if that is the conclusion, I'm personally happy to accept it.
Thank you, Dr. Medamadi. Brother Waji is also saying he can ask. Brother Blue is fantastic, so I'm going to ask him to unmute his mic and ask the question.
Assalamu alaikum. If you can't understand me, just ask me to repeat, I don't mind. So my question was this: are you saying that the apophatical model of the sanctity of life is the shkik, and is that where humans' sanctity of life comes from? Is it due to the shkik, and is that ontologically? And then part B of my question is that, are you using Aristotle's virtue mean theory to say that humans cultivate good habits and that's how they become sacred and that's how they acquire this sanctity of life? Shukran.
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, first of all, maybe I needed to explain a little bit what is negative theology or apophatic theology, but I deliberately actually left it for the Q&A because I personally prefer a very short presentation. If something is not clear, then we can discuss it about it in Q&A. So, but very briefly, what is apophatic theology or negative theology? Very briefly, it is a theological position in all monotheistic religions, specifically Islam, saying that God, linguistically, it has a different aspects, but linguistically, it says that God cannot be described in a positive way. We cannot say what God is. Rather, all we can say is what God is not. So God is not jahil. But it doesn't mean that God is alim. God is not knowing in the sense that we perceive. No, even in that sense, God is not alim. God is neither, in a sense, God is neither alim nor jahil. Rather, God is beyond ilm and jahil. So if you remember Nietzsche's title, Beyond Good and Evil, so God is beyond good and evil. God is beyond jahil and ilm. And any other actually concepts or binary concepts. So this is the linguistic or semantic aspect of the negative theology. And of course it has the epistemological consequences. And the epistemological consequences are that God cannot be perceived theoretically. It doesn't say that God cannot be known at all. Of course, there are a very radical version of, negative theology in contemporary French philosophy by Jacques Derrida, others who would say that. But at least in medieval time, no one says in apophatic tradition that God cannot be known at all. But of course, if you look at the literature, the theological literature, you would find that apophatic theologian have always been accused of ta'til, denying God or denying the knowledge of God. But I don't know, maybe some of them can be rightly accused of this, I don't know, but generally speaking, that accusation is just a mere accusation, because they actually deny the theoretical or speculative knowledge of God in order to pave the way for, to put it in a very vague way or ambiguous way, to pave the way for non-theoretical or non-speculative knowledge of God, which is usually is very mystical or esoteric, but not necessarily that. I'm saying not necessarily, and this is very important, because there is a very interesting development in Twelver Shi'i apophatic theology in contemporary time. We have a group called Maktab Tafkik or Maktab Ma'arifi Khurasan, Mirza Mahdi Isfahani and others. They are apophatic, they are highly apophatic, but they are not mystical. Actually, they are anti-mystical. So that general understanding that apophatic theology is closely related or intimately tied with mysticism is not like that. I mean, of course, apophatic tendencies among mystical theology is very strong, but they cannot be totally overlapped. So we have a non-mystical version of apophatic theology like Tafkiki's. So I forgot the second part of your question. Can you just repeat it, please?
So the second part of the question was that, are you referring to Aristotle's golden mean theory in acquiring good habits? Is that what makes a person sacred or gives them sanctity of life? Because one part is ontological. All right.
Of course, when we are referring to the virtue ethics, of course, Aristotle comes to our mind. But the position I'm taking is not necessarily Aristotelian, especially the golden mean. At least not Aristotelian in the very, you know, the old version. There are neo-Aristotelians. So, but of course, the cultivation of virtue is it, so I'm referring to the virtue ethical tradition, whose father is Aristotle. But I'm more inclined into, if I'm gonna do a name dropping, if you don't mind, for example, Linda Zagzebski, a contemporary epistemologist, ethicist, and philosopher of religion, who has developed a very interesting version of both virtue ethics and virtue epistemology and virtue theology. So all these three. So this lady is amazing, Linda Zagzebski. And so that kind of virtue theology, which actually has a potential to reformulate radically the sanctity of life argument in bioethics literature, I think is very promising. And Zagzebski is a good reference point.
So is this epistemologically, because your previous point was about ontologically, and is this working from down up now, this acquiring virtues?
Of course it has ontological point and epistemological point, but yes, it, of course, it's down up in the sense, if I use that metaphor of down up, yeah, which is a very good point here. So it is down up in the sense that there are no such a very general rules that can be applied equally or roughly on everyone. It's not like that. There is no such a thing as a very general principles, ethical or otherwise. Rather, in order to be virtuous, one should cultivate virtues within him or herself. the end result might not be the same. So if I cultivate virtues, the end result might be different from you cultivating virtues. But all we might... Carry on, please.
Isn't that all subjective then? We can all go in our own ways.
A very good critic, and a very serious one, and a very challenging one. So, before going any further, let me say that I'm against subjectivism, and I'm with you that if virtue ethics end up becoming thoroughly subjectivistic, I'm against it. But there are ways to guarantee a minimal objectivity, even within virtue ethical tradition. How? It's a matter of debate. But I totally agree with you that the minimal objectivity for any healthy and good ethical system is needed. I'm saying system. We know that virtue ethics are even against system. So yeah, that's a challenge. That's a very... And by the way, let's not forget, going back to the Quran, an amazing and inspiring story of Abd Saleh and Musa in the Quran. And Abd Saleh is virtue ethicist and Musa is objectivist. Musa says, okay, this is the rule and you are violating it. You should not kill an innocent kid. But Abd Saleh did it because he was virtuous. And Rumi says, if you are virtuous, whatever you do is right. Whatever you do is right. And Abd Saleh was virtuous. And of course you would say, wow, this is a very dangerous theory. If you're virtuous, you can do whatever. You can kill people, you can banish people, stuff like that. And I totally agree with you. This is a very dangerous idea. But there are ways to find a minimal objectivity that can be added to virtue ethical. So all I'm saying is that virtue ethics has a potential and also has a challenges. And the challenge of challenge of lapsing into the total subjectivity is the case, as it is shown in the Moses and Abd Saleh story in the Quran, which is amazing story. But there are ways to find a way. But even that ways only could guarantee very, very minimal objectivity. Beyond that, I'm sure that it cannot be actualized. Within virtue ethics or even... Okay, let's forget virtue ethics. Let's suppose we are utilitarian, okay? The most objectivist ethicists are utilitarians, okay? To maximize the pleasure, minimize the pain. But even here, maximal objectivity is not attainable. But because pleasure according to whom? I mean, my pleasure is different from yours. So to maximize my pleasure might be to minimize your pleasure. You know, so even those who actually claim the very airtight objectivity, they end up being unsuccessful. Yeah.
Thank you,
Dr. Mehdi Amari, for wonderful answer. So it's funny actually that you brought up the story of Musa and Abd Saleh. I was having a discussion some years back with a critical rationalist about this, a Muslim of course, about this this story, and of course how it was not fitting with his mindset and his approach was that the information that Abd Saleh or Khidr, some people say it was him, was privy to, the public was not privy to it, and they could not make a judgment, and he is not able to make a judgment and enact them and apply them by himself without that knowledge being for public consumption. There's quite a wonderful discussion we had on that as well. There's a question here which has been asked via text, so I'll just read it out. It's completely somewhat disjointed from what you were asking just now. and dealing with just now. The question is as such: what is the relevance of the husband's consent for the permissibility of abortion for Hanafi jurists?
Oh, okay. Because notfa belongs to the husband, and the womb of the mother's womb is only a place in which the notfa is gonna be actually thrived. That's why, from Hanafi, not only Hanafi, but in this case, because the question is about Hanafi, the consent of the husband is the key. Even okay, so that permission is probably the most liberal jurisprudential rule with regard to the abortion. Those Hanafis would say before 120 days, okay, you are tired, okay? There is no medical reason. You are tired. You want to abort your fetus. You are allowed. Or you want to get your MA. If you get your husband permission, that's okay. But husband permission is still needed because that fetus belongs to him because notfa came from him.
Thank you. I hope that answers the question for that person who had asked. Brother, we are going to close very shortly, but I will take a couple more questions since they are coming from the chat. I'll ask Brother Ahmed Kauri to come to ask his question. I'll ask him also at this point to keep it brief so Dr. Mirdamali has the opportunity to answer appropriately. So if you can keep that succinct, it'll be very appreciated. Thank you.
I'm sorry, just a quick note, sorry to interrupt there. There's a couple of questions actually that were written on the chat, Sheikh Tajri, by Shayan and Afnan, I think. Just a quick reminder. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Ahmed. If you can ask and I'll go back to those questions. hopefully we will have time for them. You go on, Ahmed.
Okay. Assalamu alaikum again. Wouldn't we say that it's not really sanctity that is needed to preserve human life? It seems like, from an Islamic perspective at least, is that running away from the tests of this world is completely, how can I say, is not allowed. It's forbidden. It's forbidden. But also, human life has a right to exist in this world prior to the afterlife.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that the right base theory, it might be more promising, that sanctity of life theory. And one more point related to one of the previous question, especially the one that very, very interestingly brought the idea of a hereafter. Okay. You know, even in the hereafter, for example, we have also hell in the hereafter. Is it sacred? The hell is sacred? Of course, from even Ibn Arabi perspective, God's mercy encompasses even the hell. Of course. Even from his perspective. But it doesn't mean that the hell is sacred. Of course, God's benevolence and mercy is everywhere. Encompasses وَرَحْمَتِي وَسَعَدْ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ. But it doesn't mean that qadasa kul wasa'at kull shay. Qadasa is very special or taqaddus or however you put it in Arabic. I don't know exactly. Qadasa, taqaddus, quds, whatever. It doesn't mean that I've never come across somewhere saying that qadasatullah wasa'at kull shay. Taqaddusullah wasa'at kull shay. No, rahmati. The God's mercy or God's benevolence encompasses everything. But not qidasa. Qidasa is very specific and special things, which is reserved for specific places and specific figures. And when you go to that thing, they acquired it. Of course, this is also fazlullah. This is God's mercy or God's grace bestowed upon them. But they have not been passive. They have also done something. Okay, so this is an acquired, theme. And of course, if we put aside the sanctity of life, let's suppose that if we altogether, let's suppose we altogether put aside the sanctity of life argument. Still, we have, as our friend just suggested, we have a lot of other considerations to handle our problems. Right-based, interest-based, fairness, justice, a lot of other concepts we have in our actually hand to handle these controversial issues. So I don't think that sanctity of life would do justice to bioethical issues, and I don't think that it would do justice to concept of sanctity. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Mehdamadi. I'll ask at this point Shayan Shirazi if they have access to a mic to ask the question verbally if possible. If not, I will ask on their behalf. I'll read it. So Shayan, do you have access to a mic, or are you able to ask the question verbally? You may go ahead and do so now. If they are not able to, I'll read it out anyway here. On the chat, it says, Salam, how do the premises entail conclusion 5? Human life may not be intrinsically sacred, but can they not acquire sanctity by God's will and action? I hope I asked it appropriately. I don't know exactly what the question meant to myself, but it's here on the chat. If if you can access the chat, you can read it yourself.
Okay. Let me see how I can access. Okay, meeting chat. Okay.
A bit lower down still. Yes.
Shayan Shirazi, I got it. Salam. How do the premises entail conclusion 5? Human life may not be intrinsically sacred, but can they not acquire sanctity but God's will and action? Okay, so let's get back to 5. Human life as such is not sacred. Sanctity of life is not defensible. Okay. Okay. Okay, let me put it in this way. There are, that actually question, if I got it right, put me in a position to add something into reformulation of sanctity of life argument in the light of apophatic position. There are some scholars in Christian theology working on bioethics, suggesting that, okay, before going into their suggestion, let me say. So we have two radical versions, one might say. One is that one is intrinsically valuable, the human life is intrinsically sacred, and the other, at the other end of the spectrum, a theory that human life as such is not intrinsically sacred at all, rather it is only sacred in an acquired way. There are some scholars who have tried to come up with a middle position, okay? And this is also very interesting, saying that, okay, potentially we are sacred, potentially, not actually. Potentially we all human beings are sacred in the sense that we can acquire sacredness. You know, this, I don't know, maybe this stone, this table, this laptop cannot acquire even potentially sacredness. But human beings could potentially acquire sacredness. That ontological difference between me and stone gives me a kind of special ontological status which can be called not intrinsic value, which is actually everywhere, but potential value, a kind of potent, a kind of capability, which can be actualized or cannot. But those who are actually sacred are those who have done their best to actualize that sanctity and sacredness. And these middle position scholars, therefore, they made a distinction between sacred and sanctity. That potential, that potentiality, which is all among us, they called it sacred. That acquired sanctity that we can acquire, they called it sanctity. So we are all sacred from their position, but we do not have sanctity. So sanctity is acquired, but sacredness is potential already there. So if I ask your question right, if I got your question right, so your question can be put as a kind of objection to this model. That if human life is not sacred, then how can we acquire sanctity? And the answer would be, because we are created in such a way that we have a potentiality to acquire sanctity. Okay? And for that response to work, of course we should make a middle position. Not a very radical position, saying that we are not even potentially sacred. Because, you know, actuality means potentially. We know this from Aristotle. So actuality means, if something is actualized, it's a sign that it's already there potentially. Therefore, that middle position, I think, is a good position that might save sanctity of life theory, but without giving it too much credit, which might compromise the theological concept of sanctity, which is, by the way, at the end is reserved for God and God only. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. There's one more question from Afnan. I think it'll be the final question we take. If Afnan has a mic and is able to ask it verbally, it's already there on the chat, I'm sure, Dr. Medamad, you can see it, but sometimes it may not be understood great unless the person is there live, able to ask themselves. I would appreciate that. If not, then we have the text about the fasid. So if Afnan, are you able to ask the question verbally? Then you may go ahead and unmute your mic and ask.
Salaam alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
My question is that from when you were answering another question, you said that by taking a life which belongs to someone who is perfect or someone who is, let's say, for example, a serial killer or a just a murderer in general, then we are doing a favor by preserving life. So this means that it is not a crime. This is what I understood from you. But I was just like, what about when the Quran says to forgive and to love someone and to give them chances, because anyone can improve and become better? Yeah, hope that makes sense.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Afnan. Actually, yeah, of course. I mean, the preference of the Quran is always to forgive in the case of conflict. But of course, there are cases in which forgiving is not gonna work. Okay, if someone attacks you, you should defend yourself. Of course, you can, as Imam Hussein did, he tried to actually give them advice, to convince them, this is not what you are supposed to do. Do remember me, who I am. This is as Ali did with the Khawarij, first try to convince them. This is what should be done. But at the end, if someone is gonna kill you and no other precautionary measures work, you have to defend yourself. And in some other cases, if someone is trying to actually destroy your house, you have to defend yourself. In some cases, defending yourself requires killing others. Still, it's defensive in the sense that you do not begin to kill others. You're only defending yourself. But defending yourself in some cases requires killing others. And in that cases, of course, that killing might be justified killing.
Dr. Medamad, if I might take that question a step further, you mentioned in the context of self-defense But in another context of punishability in hudud and taking a life as a punishment, then, and you said, yes, of course, the preference, the Quranic preference in the, from the ethos of the Quran is always pardoning and forgiveness. But by taking a life as a means of punishment for a crime, in the context of what you've been saying, is that not denial of the potentiality of that soul to acquire godliness and goodness?
That is exactly where the idea of hereafter might come in to help us to actually preserve that potentiality. Let me bring here Ibn Arabi, because Ibn Arabi says that there is a problem always with how to reconcile Ibn Arabi's teaching with the zawahir of the Quran. But putting that aside, he says that for those who are in the hell, the worst punishment is not fire and stuff like that, stones, hot stones. No, the worst punishment for those who are in the hell is that they realize that they have actually missed God. This is, you know, this is the worst punishment for them. And you might say, okay, it is not very Islamic stuff like that. But if you refer to the Du'a Kumail, attributed to Imam Ali through Kumail, there is something quite similar there. Okay, and by the way, there is some theories that Ibn Arabi was deeply influenced by Shi'i theology, which I think is not so bad theory. It might be at least partially defended. He says there, Imam Ali, that if you put me in the hell, I would cry that I miss you. As if the worst thing that has happened to that person is not that he's in the hell among the fire. No, that he's apart from God. So that theory, if we take that theory, if we take hell, like Ibn Arabi, or what is implied in the Du'a Kumail, as a therapeutic place, not a place in which there is a villain who is going to torture you. No, no, it's not like that. If we take hell as a therapeutic place, therefore, the potentiality of the sacredness is even there. And of course, you might push it further, saying that what about the khulud fil azab? What about the eternality of the hell? Then we can discuss, okay? We can discuss further about the eternality of the hell. Because if someone is eternally in the hell, then the idea of the potentiality of the sacredness is compromised. Then, I think even the eternality of the hell can be discussed. I don't want to go further into it, but just a hint. In the Quran, there are few verses that they says that they're gonna be hell. Ma damat as-samawat wal ars. They're gonna be in the hell, illa ma sha Allah. There are few verses saying that, which might give us a hint that, inshallah, hell will not be eternal. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mirza Ahmadi. I have to thank you because your fascinating presentation and subsequent answers to the questions have engendered a lot of discussion and a vibrant discussion, which has been fantastic. Before we do close, and before I finally give my final thanks to Dr. Yasir Mirza Ahmadi, I want to just point out that if all of you who are participating before you start leaving the meeting, if you on the chat on the right-hand side of your screen, if you scroll down all the way down on the chat, you will see that Brother Ali Rada has put a post, I think it's the third post from the bottom. It's a URL address. If you would like to remain updated about our events and these virtual events and events at the Institute when this coronavirus issue is over, please do sign up to this URL and put in your details, and you will be kept updated and in the know about the events running at the Al-Mahdi Institute, which are like the fascinating discussion you have just been an audience to. So on that note, I would like to thank as someone on the chat, Shayan has just said on the chat, an excellent discussion. Indeed it was. I would like to thank Dr. Yasir Mirdamadi for his time, for having given us a very enlightening and a wonderful discussion, and a very vibrant question and answer session as well. So thank you once again. We can give you a virtual round of applause, although had we been there in person, you would have got a real round of applause. So thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Sheikh Tajri and Ali Reza and Mahdi and all others who made this actually virtual research seminar possible. Thanks for having me. I benefited a lot from your question. And we can actually continue this. Thank you very much. Cheers. Bye. Khuda hafiz.